All right. Book of Exodus today, part 10, we'll be in. And we're going to be in chapter 11. And actually, I have inspirations of getting through all the way through chapter 12 today. So 11's kind of short, but I have quite a bit of reading, but I realize we just lost a few of our readers. So you guys are going to have to bear the load, I guess. Okay, so here in at the closing of chapter 10, last week we saw where there was a plague of darkness over the land, and we talked about how that was an illustration of the darkness to come, or the dark days for ahead for Egypt. And that today we're going to look at what is going to become known as the last or the final plague that's going to fall upon the nation of Egypt there. So that's kind of where we're going to turn today. And it actually, this stretches out for a lot of these other plagues was half a chapter, or, you know, a few verses and stuff. This is actually going to stretch out for a couple chapters before we kind of see this all come together. So a little more detail, maybe a little bit more involved. And as I mentioned in my lesson today, there's a lot more implication for the people in this plague than there has been in the previous nine. I think their intentions, we've talked quite a bit about the purpose of all this, is to show people who the true God really is. But I think this last plague here has a lot of implications as far as people and their mindset moving forward from this point. So it kind of changes maybe a little bit, still a very physical thing, obviously, for the people there, whether it's Egypt or the nation of Israel. But there's some more maybe mental or spiritual things are gonna start to build from this, I believe. So that's what we're going to look at today. So we'll start in Exodus chapter 11, verse 1. Somebody like to try that?
Now the Lord said to Moses, "One more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from him, from your people."
Okay, so we see here if this is the final plague, it's the last one. And the Lord says, "One more plague I will bring." And then after this plague, Pharaoh's going to let you go. He will drive you from the land. He's going to make you go, I guess you could say at this point. And so I just have thought to myself, like, at this point now, you know, how's Moses feeling about all this? Does he have any room for doubt? I mean, this has happened nine times previously. You know, the Lord has told him we're going to have this plague. And, I mean, this has went on for a while. Moses is maybe thinking, man, you know, this is a lot of things that went on here. Is this really going to be the last one? But I don't think he's doubting. I really don't. I think Moses has seen God work. And in all of the previous plagues, we see the interaction with God and Moses. God always tells Moses, go tell Pharaoh to do this, or we're going to bring this plague, but he's not going to let you go. See, Moses already knows what's going to happen, and this time the Lord tells him, after this, he's going to let you go. He's going to drive you out of here. So I think Moses, I don't think he does have any doubt. I think Moses at this point has a lot of faith. And throughout this process, it built, I think, an intense faith within Moses. I think, and then we see that as he portrays that throughout, you know, all the sons of Israel. So I think Moses is, because we know earlier on he was kind of, you know, when he first started out, we saw this guy that was struggling a little bit, you know, how to handle all this stuff. I think Moses is fully on board at this point now, and he knows that the God's going to do what he says. Somebody like to read verses 2 and 3 now, please. We'll touch on this. Okay, before we talk about that much, let's turn back in Exodus just to chapter 3. Just turn back to Exodus 3, verses 21 and 22. Okay, so remember this from earlier on when God is talking to Moses. He tells him, you're going to plunder the Egyptians when you go. And when you think about plundering your enemy, what's the vision that comes into your head? You see these guys in battle, you know, going through the cities and gathering everything and stealing everything. And as I read this in chapter 11 there, I thought, well, this is how they plunder them. The Egyptians hand this stuff over to them. It says to request from your neighbor articles of silver and gold, and the Egyptians give it to them. Interesting, I thought. That's a very, because as we know in this story, they don't conquer the nation of Egypt. They don't come in the terms of conquering. You know, they don't come wipe Pharaoh out in the armies and plunder the cities and in the households. I mean, what do? They pack up and leave in the middle of the night. And whatever they have with them, they take. But they had all their stuff with them. I thought, that's interesting how God, you know, allowed that to have a very different plundering is one we're used to seeing. And Moses, like I said, he was instructed from the beginning. And I don't know if this was something that was really in the forefront of his mind or their mind or whatever. But they were probably thinking, well, how are we going to plunder these people? And we can't do anything against them. But I think this is a way that God is showing them, hey, I told you you were gonna leave here rich, right? You just need that faith. I have a way of doing it. I think it's another little piece that God has put in there to help them to build their faith and to understand that he can do anything that he wants. And what he says he's going to do, he's going to find a way to do it for you, whether you think it's the way it should be done or not. Because I'm sure when they were thinking about plundering the Egyptians' riches, this is not what they had in mind when they were told that. So I thought that was interesting. And another thing that is interesting here in this section is in verse 3, it says, the people found favor in the sight of the Egyptians. I thought that was interesting. These people that were their slaves, they were, I mean, obviously well beneath them, but the Egyptians found favor within these people. That was interesting. And yes? I think you're absolutely right. I think that was a big part of the purpose all along was to build that you probably don't want to call it faith, but you know, the belief that they would know that the God of Israel is much more powerful than their gods. And maybe even at this point there could have been a lot of people that were kind of like, you know, they were done with Pharaoh. I mean, Pharaoh has brought a lot of hardship on him at this point because he's refusing. And maybe a lot of people that thought, you know, this nation and their God is pretty powerful, and they had a lot of respect for that. And I think that's maybe a very good point how they had found that favor within him. Roy, you got your hand up. I don't know. I wish I knew. I haven't found like any evidence of that either way. And I was thinking also about, you know, I guess we're going to talk about here too, you know, about the last plague where they had to sacrifice the lamb. But was that only for the nation of Israel, or did the Egyptians have that option if they chose to be obedient? I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't. We'll look a little closer as we read it. And I don't know if that's something that was directed directly to...
How could they not? That all the gods fell, clearly that the God of the Jewish people is the only God.
Right.
And I bet you there were some Egyptians that converted over to Jesus.
And I wonder, because, and I mean, God is always willing to, if somebody is willing to be obedient, do the right thing, He's willing to extend His grace to them. And I wondered that before too, but... Right. And really, I mean, at this time too, this is prior to the law. You know, there's not, you know, the requirements of the law are not here. So these people that are enslaved in Egypt there are literally the physical descendants of Abraham at that point. And, you know, so that's, you know, the nation there of Israel. And, you know, so they wouldn't have had to have, you know, jumped through the hoops, so to speak, of becoming Jews or whatever. So I'm not sure, you know, or if it was a case in point where, you know, the nation of Egypt was corrupt and God was going to bring judgment upon them and they were going to reap what they sowed, possibly too. I'm not sure. So interesting thoughts, though.
And the problem there was is that they were scared of Pharaoh. You know,
right. I would have thought, yeah, I think so. And like the second part of this verse 3 there, it says, Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. So the Egyptians, you know, looked pretty highly upon Moses, you know, the servants and the people. So it wasn't, you know, there was obviously, and I would think that the reference there to Pharaoh's servants are people that would, you know, higher up or, you know, have authority, or, you know, more established or esteemed people, you know, have a lot of respect for Moses. You know, so if they're respecting him, or, you know, if he's greatly esteemed, obviously they're thinking, or they're kind of okay with what Moses is doing at this point. So I think it wasn't necessarily the case where the whole nation of Egypt was just strongly against God and against Israel. I mean, I don't think all of their hearts were hardened like Pharaoh's was. So, Ken, yeah.
How long did Moses live in Egypt?
Let's see, how was that? It was, when he left, he was 40. Yeah. And then when he came back, he was 80. Yeah. So, but he was there for 40 years. So he was pretty well, and he grew up in Pharaoh's household. He was pretty well known, you know, throughout the nation too. So when he came back, probably a lot of people recognized him and, you know, oh, I remember him. And stuff. So he had some previous history with them as well. So he wasn't a complete stranger necessarily. He was probably more of a stranger to the nation of Israel or the, you know, sons of Israel than he was to the Egyptians, really.
But he was there with the Israelites too. They were there as well.
Right. Yeah.
Well, no, I don't think they were all the time, but they were. Because what happened was, you know, he was put there because
right.
They took and hid him in a body of water somewhere. So then Pharaoh's daughter found him and nursed, you know, kept him.
Yeah.
And that's why he was there to start with. But there sure was for a long period of time.
The Israelites were in the land of Goshen.
Yeah, they probably.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
I don't know if they were under Pharaoh, Egyptian. Probably were.
Yeah.
They were slaves. He came slaves at some point because Moses killed the Egyptian.
Yeah.
Harsh.
Yeah, I think they were enslaved. I think before Moses was born.
Maybe they were.
Because that was when the rulers changed hand. In the first part of that chapter, he didn't favor them like Pharaoh did. You know, Pharaoh, the previous one was, you know, thought quite a bit of Joseph and his family and had a lot of favor towards them. Yeah, that was, it's just in chapter 1 there. Um, And verse 8 says, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, 'Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply in event and war.'" So he appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities. And then the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. So that was prior to Moses being born. So he was born and raised there in an Egyptian household while his fellow Israelites were in slavery. So
he probably had a fairly pampered life, was taught the sciences in Egypt.
Yeah.
He was a prince, basically, since he's adopted son of the princess.
Yeah. Right. He's probably a pretty highly educated, respectable, respected man, I think, with his way he was raised, probably. So.
He abdicated.
Yeah.
He's probably kind of like a brother to the current Pharaoh that he's dealing with.
Yeah, well, I think he might have actually been like a half-brother to him. Because the Pharaoh's daughter that rescued him, I think it was her brother that was in power at this point here, now like in chapter 11. So, I mean, he would have been older than Moses, probably, but wouldn't have necessarily had to have been a whole lot older, though, but it probably was a little bit, and so they probably grew up together even some. So I think that some of the, you know, we talked about, was it just last week, you know, why didn't Pharaoh just get tired of him and just kill him? Like, he probably had, you know, a pretty good relationship, you know, Pharaoh didn't want to kill his little brother very bad either, so. Kind of different aspects or different pictures you don't always think about when you think about this story, but there's a lot of similarities between Moses and Pharaoh, I guess, as they grew up. So I think we see that carry over into why the people, you know, were he was greatly esteemed in the servants and the people, as we saw. I think it wasn't just, I mean, obviously what God has done here with the previous plagues, I mean, it's changed the way people think a lot. But Moses might have had some of that. They might have looked upon him a little bit with favor prior to this as well. So, just a thought on that, I guess. But
returns from the desert with God that's more powerful than all their gods, and he's more powerful.
Right.
The king, so yeah, I mean, I'm sure they looked upon.
Yeah, and that's been strongly demonstrated here previously in the previous nine plagues. So, okay, so now moving on, read a little bit more here, verses 4 through 10, we kind of see where the parameters of this final plague are kind of laid out. So I'd like to read that. Okay, so we see what's going to happen here with this last plague. At midnight, all the firstborn of the land are going to die. From Pharaoh to the servants, even the cattle. There'll be a great cry throughout the land. But then Israel will not be touched. So, kind of that maybe a little bit answers our question a little bit there earlier too. It does give a distinction there between the land of Egypt and then in verse 7, it says, against any of the sons of Israel. So unless some of the Egyptian people at this point are being grouped in and considered sons of Israel, I don't think they would I don't think they'd have been passed over. And I'm not sure at this point. It's my understanding that when you read at this point, sons of Israel, they're talking about the literal descendants of Abraham here. So I kind of wonder if, I don't know, if maybe none of the Egyptians did or were allowed to their firstborn to be spared, I guess.
Even if they were believers, maybe they still
have. They may have. I wonder.
Pretty morbid deal, isn't it?
Really is.
I mean, everybody lives all the way through their livestock and their kids.
Yeah, it's incredible, really. And then in verse 7 there, it says that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. So, to me, this starts showing implications for the future here. Obviously, God is going to see a difference between the people of Egypt and Israel. And obviously, he didn't need to see a sign on their door to know who they were, right? He needed to see that sign on the door to know what they believed and whether they believed him or not. So he didn't need to see that distinction for them. That distinction was for them to be saved. So I thought that was interesting there. And then I think that's going to, again, show people the lesson that if we want to be saved, we got to do what God says. I mean, it's a simple illustration there, really. Because, I strongly and very strongly believe that any of the sons of Israel at this point, if they did not do what they were told there, if they didn't sacrifice the lamb, put the blood on the post, the angel of death did not pass over them, whether they were in that nation or not. I mean, they had to do what they were told. And so, and then in the last part of this section here, we see the people are going to, they're going to come and bow down and they're going to say, "Go, you people, get out of here." I mean, the nation of Egypt was needing them to be gone at this point. What did it say in verse 6? "Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before and such as never will be again." I mean, it was, you think about that. I mean, the nation of Egypt was mighty at this point, both in, I mean, just in population, there's a lot of them. And when you think about the firstborn, sometimes I think we, for some reason, have a tendency to think of the firstborn babies. You know, you think of the little babies being killed. But no, it's the firstborn of the household. Whether you're 6 months or 60 years old, if you're the firstborn son, you died. So, I mean, it was a big deal. You know, it was a very strong, undeniable message that God sent to, you know, to these people at this point. Right.
All these things were pretty devastating,
yeah,
situations, you know, for the Egyptians, but Pharaoh he didn't want to give up, I guess.
No. And really, that's the way you look throughout all of history and the time that God has brought judgment upon mankind. You know, you think about the flood, or example, like Sodom and Gomorrah and different things. Like, he's never done those things twice. He says, "I'll never do that again like that." And he hasn't. So I thought that kind of fit this category here. I mean, I think the nation of Egypt at that given point in time, they played a role in God's big plan and the role in eternity. I mean, the purpose there was to show who God really was. And it wasn't just for those people right then and there. It was for us today still, too. I mean, to read this story and to have an understanding of what he did there, it's going to build our faith in knowing that, hey, this truly is it. Only the true God could do these things, for sure. So that was chapter 11. We just kind of looked ahead to this, the last plague here. Now chapter 12, and we might struggle to get through all this today, and that's not a big deal if we don't either. There's a lot of things we can talk about here, and I wasn't going to dig just totally deep into all of it because it'd take us quite a while. We're going to talk about about this plague a little bit more. We're going to talk about the Passover lamb, as is known, becomes be known as, and then the blood and stuff, and how they were saved, and what goes on to happen to the nation of Egypt there. So that's kind of what we're going to look at here. So if somebody like to read verses 1 through 6 of Exodus 12.
Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the tenth of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves, according to their father's household, and a lamb for each household. Now, if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them, according to which, to what each man should eat, you are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be unblemished, male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight.
Okay, so now we kind of see, I touched on this earlier too, is the faith of the sons of Israel, it quickly goes from passive to active obedience. Now we have to do, you know, before God has just brought these plagues upon Egypt, we're here in the land of Goshen, he spared us, right? We haven't felt these plagues. But they haven't done anything to ward off the plagues at this point. God has just saved, has just done that for them. Now all of a sudden, they got to do something, right? And they're given very specific directions on what to do. He talks about the days, or you start with the month, and then the days, and then take the lamb, and how do you divide it among your household, or who needs to have one, when when to kill it, and whatnot, and then it talks about you should keep it in verse 6, or keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill at twilight, okay? So it's not just, they have specific instructions on what, this is what you have to do here. And as we know through studying, the Jewish law, and we're going to actually look at this a little bit here in just a minute, some of their religious, their feasts and their festivals and stuff. I mean, they had this, to celebrate the Passover every year, on this certain day, go through this certain process as a remembrance of the day that the Lord passed over them, right, and saved them. So I think at this point, I think as we study in this, I think it's good, we should start looking for the comparisons between the requirements of Israel for salvation and the people of today. And the requirements are different, but we need to look at it as far as physically versus spiritually and kind of get our mindset thinking about how God, he hasn't changed how he works, just the process is a little bit different. And again, the old covenant has always been a foreshadow of a new covenant to come. And we're really starting to see, the beginning part of some of that covenant as the ideals kind of build together.
And then we can see that he's a loving God and he's a just God. So when you look at all these places.
Yeah, very just. Oops, technical difficulties here. Come here. Sometimes this thing, I think, has a mind of its own. Now it's going to freeze up or something. Well, this thing is not responding here. Well, I guess we can, it'll work like that. For some reason, all my stuff up here is not working. But anyway, we can still see it, I guess. So that's all that matters at this point. It might go back here. Okay. Now let's move on to in chapter 12 here to verse 7 through 13, if someone would like to read that. 7 through 13. Okay, so now we get specifics on what they should do with the blood here from the sack of the lamb that they killed. Verse 7, it says, you take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the house in which they eat it. And then it gives instructions on how to eat the lamb, roast with fire, eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Don't eat any of it raw or boiled with water. But roast with fire, and not leave any of it over until morning. And then in verse 11, tells them how they should eat it too. You eat it in this manner: your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in haste. So basically, you get this picture like they're grabbing something to eat as they're headed out the door. You know, really, you know, it's not something. It's not a big banquet where they sit around and celebrate and enjoy this grand meal together, really, is it? And then when you think about, and then this is a, you know, this sign that is on their door is, in verse 11, it's the Lord's Passover. This is what is gonna allow him to pass over your house and spare your firstborn. Because in verse 12, he says, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. And then the blood is going to be a sign for you and your houses where you live. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. So it's referred to as the Passover because he literally passes over the houses that have this sign upon them. So it's going to be referred to as the Lord's Passover there. And then, I wonder if I might have missed that slide. Hey, nice. Man, it's good to have smart people around with me. All right. So we see where the beginning, you know, the term Passover is a pretty common thing in today's society still, because the Jews, people that try to practice this, I say, because they really can't successfully be Jews, whether they think they are or not, but that's kind of another story there. But you know, they still every year on this special day, they do all these certain things, and because they're trying to recognize this Passover that took place then. And then, well,
this wasn't like the other ones. God went and said this is going to happen. Whatever, they spent 14 days preparing for this.
Yeah.
Yep. Their lamb, and they had to keep it for 14 days before they prepared the meal.
Is it for,
you talked about the 10th of the month. And
let's see.
The 14th month.
On the 10th of this month, you take a lamb, and then you shall keep it until the 14th day. So 4 days. He took the lamb on the 10th, and kept. But still, there was something that, you know, he didn't just say, "Well, this is happening tonight." They had to they had to do this. They had to get the lamb. You know, they had to take part of this, and it wasn't something that was just like automatically done for them. And they had to think about it and put it into action a little bit too. And yeah, that was, you know, he said at midnight this is going to happen, but it was midnight of a specific day there. It was, you know, after they had the opportunity to have their lamb and stuff. So then another portion of this that there's a lot more to go along with this also farther, and we'll see some of this in Leviticus. We're going to look at it a little bit too. Then you have the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. Somebody like to read verses 14 through 18, please.
Anything leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day you shall have a holy assembly, and another holy assembly on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done on them, except what must be eaten by every person. That alone may be prepared by you.
Would you want to go through 18, please?
Oh, to 18.
Would you mind?
You shall also observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on this very day I brought you your host out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at evening you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening.
Okay, so this is God's looking forward, or moving forward here with the, you know, this feast of unleavened bread. It's a permanent ordinance. He referred to it as, you know, you do this every year on a certain day to remember that, hey, this is when I brought you out of captivity, and it's something that you do for generations as a permanent ordinance. And the word permanent there really rang out to me, because how could, you know, something permanent is something that is forever, right? And well, this that we know that under the new covenant, this is not something that is required. It's not something that we do. But it's a foreshadow of what we do, right? Our Lord's Supper, right? We do that to remember what? The day that we're brought out of captivity. Not physically, but spiritually. We're set free from that slavery of sin. And we do that to remember that. And to be reminded of who we are as Christians. And these people are doing it to be reminded of who they were as God's people at that time. So I just think that's, a comparison or a foreshadow there that that God is showing them. And not just showing them, but showing all generations. And
yeah, it was quite a bit of work involved there.
Yeah, it was.
It was an ordeal.
Yeah, it was something they had to actively, physically do to keep these ordinances. And okay, so to break this down just a little bit here, it was on the first month, 14th day, at evening is when they ate the Passover. And they ate that with unleavened bread. So starting on that, on the 14th, you had unleavened bread in your house, and then nothing leavened until the 21st day at evening. So that's a total of 8 days of unleavened bread. You got the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st. You got 8 days there, right? So you got the first day is your Passover, And then you have your Feast of Unleavened Breads for 7 days. And if we turn to Leviticus, which is just the next chapter or the next book over, Leviticus 23, and in this section of Leviticus here, it's kind of outlining and all of the different the laws of the religious festivals and the things that the Jewish people did, and it talks about this Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So Leviticus 23, and I can read here, and I'll start in verse 5. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at twilight, is the Lord's Passover. Then on the 15th day of the same month, there is a Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. But for 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the seventh day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. So this is one of their the law of their religious festival. This is one of them. This is the one that God gave them in the land of Egypt. There, you're supposed to do this to, you know, for the purpose of remembering when I brought you out of captivity. And it's something that they were doing, and it's recorded there, in amongst, you know, their ordinances. It was something that was that. Obviously was, you know, wasn't something that got forgotten about them, you know, by them, or, you know, something they were doing. They were keeping that they were being faithful with the celebration of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread and stuff. So if we turn back to Exodus chapter 12 and 21 and 22. Somebody like to read that, please. Okay, again, back to the instructions on what they should be doing for this Passover. Again, same, you know, he's telling them again, take the blood from the lamb, put it on the lintel and the two doorposts, and the Lord will pass over. And will not allow the destroyer to come in the houses to smite you. And I think Royce was, and I were talking about this before class here, I think as the King James refers to as the angel of death, or the destroyer. It kind of both build a picture of something that, I mean, not a pleasant event by any means. Yeah. And then again, do not, hang on a sec. And then at the end of 22, I'm sorry, I was getting ahead of myself a little bit there in verse 23. You shall not go outside the door until morning. So, again, specific instructions on what they should be doing here, and allowing them to have the opportunity, I think, to either be obedient or maybe to be lazy and try to do it their own way, and they're going to see what happens. And then I had this picture of this little lamb here, but it made me think again about the significance of why the lamb, or and when it talked about how they should eat it. I mean, you divide a lamb up amongst your household, there's not going to be very much for people to eat because they're not very big. The significance here is not the meal, it's what you're doing. And again, when we think about our Lord's Supper, it's what the emblems represent is where we get the nourishment from, and it's not from the size of the dinner or you know how we, you know, I mean, you get this, the significance of the meaning is from how we do it and why we do it, and not from the emblems themselves. I think the lamb is the same way. The significance of the lamb, and we see this more when we talk about Jesus, and he's referred to as the lamb, and his blood is what gives us forgiveness of sins. I think we see that same comparison there, again a foreshadow of what God's setting up for future there. Now if we go to verses 23 and 24. just going to pull out the King James here. Well, the King James here does refer to it as the destroyer. But I need to check. I know it says
the angel of death something.
Yeah, it does. And we'll try to, I'll try to find that maybe, or we'll try to find that. So he tells them that the Lord is going to pass through and smite the Egyptians, the firstborn of the Egyptians, but when he sees the blood on the post and the lintel, he's going to pass over and the destroyer will not come in. And then he goes on to tell them, you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. Again, we see this idea of this everlasting observance. And a couple of really key things here, I think, that, again, looking forward to the new covenant, is what saves them? Ultimately, what saves them? It's that blood on the door, right? So that you could say that blood is what saved them. Again, the blood of Jesus, his sacrifice, is what saved, you know, that's why we can be saved. And then God spared those who were obedient. The people that did what he required them to do, they were spared. And they were given life, right? Same with our spiritual life. If we're obedient and do what he requires us and what he wants us to do, we're spared. We're given our life, our eternal life. And then we, again, observe this event forever through our Lord's Supper. It's that reminder, that fellowship meal that we have together of who we are and what we have through Jesus. My little illustration there, I guess. I should have had that pulled up beforehand, huh? But talk about the similarities between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. You have the sacrificial lamb, you have Jesus, you have this Passover meal, this feast, we have the Lord's Supper. These are all things that they're not coincidences. They work hand in hand together for a purpose, for sure. And that's, I think we'll quit there with that today. In verse 24 there, we're not going to go through any more of the chapter, because there's quite a bit there still as we start talking and start seeing this event take place. But the people, you can see the people here with the sons of Israel are now given, they're put in the position when they have to start deciding. Because up to this point, you know, within these plagues, God has just spared them. And I mentioned this earlier. But now, there's things they have to do. They have to actively take part. They have to want to do these things. They have to want to belong to him and to be his people for them to live, to be saved. You know, and I truly believe that there were probably some of those that were not obedient. I think when the destroyer or the angel of death came over, I think there was, within the land of Goshen, I think there was doorposts that didn't have blood on them, and I think they suffered. And I think maybe it was maybe that was a wake-up call they needed. Thinking, holy cow, you know, maybe we should have put the blood on the posts. You know, so the next time God asked them to do something, maybe they remembered, hey, we got to do what he says. You know,
about all the details. Even no person should walk out of the house at night. What happened if they did?
Right. That might have made the rest of the stuff invalid because they didn't follow that step.
I think it did.
I think it did.
You know, because or whatever step they missed.
Right. I don't think that he didn't give them these specific instructions for them to pick and choose which ones they wanted to do. I think it was an all or nothing deal. Whether there was one requirement or whether it was four or five, like you had to do the process because that shows that you really wanted to. And I think that's ultimately what's what God wanted to see. And that's what he wants to see out of us today, too. He wants to see those of us that really want to do what he requires and to belong. So that's what I had for today. I think it's interesting for us to see. We really can start to see the comparisons here with some of the old and new covenant stuff. And I know you can pick apart, you know, the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And I mean, you can look at the time there when Jesus was killed, and you can fit all that stuff. And there's a lot to look at there. But I think from this point, we won't get into that too deep. I think that's several weeks probably worth of stuff just there. So, and Kirk has kind of went over quite a bit of that some before too. And it's pretty interesting really to see how that all fits together, both on the physical timeline, but then also in the significant meaning of when it's happening too. So again, I don't think it's coincidental that God, you know, uses those things for that purpose. But anybody else got any other comments or anything today? All right, sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.